This program contains explicit content and subject matter which may be unsuitable for some listeners. Discretion is advised.
Smart. Sexy. Kinky. Fun.
Welcome to Sex Out Loud with your host, sex educator, author, and filmmaker, Tristan Taramino. It's sex-positive radio like you've never heard before. Tristan talks about sexuality from every angle with leading authors, experts, artists, and icons. From sex education and sexual politics to BDSM and non-monogamy, nothing is off limits. So get ready to open your mind and expand your horizons. This is Sex Out Loud. And now here's your host, Tristan Taramino.
Welcome to Sex Out Loud, everyone. Hey, I really appreciate that for 7 years you've been listening to that same opening, which at this point sounds like it came from 1978. I know I love Cooper Beckett, but we've decided that we are going to actually record a new opening. And Raymond the Amazing is going to do the music. And just it's something for you to look forward to if you always fast forward this. I don't know. Hey, we're live. It's January 18th, 2019, and that also means that you can call us. Today, we're going to talk all about some tough topics, so, you know, choose your content wisely. We're talking about gender dysphoria tonight. We're live, and you can call in to join the conversation at 866-472-5788. 866-472-5788. So I want to give you a little bit of background before I introduce my guest. In November, there was a New York Times opinion piece called that was published called My New Vagina Won't Make Me Happy, and It Shouldn't Have to. It was by trans woman Andrea Long Chu, and in some ways, Chu was responding to this pretty inflammatory article in The Atlantic that Chu summarizes part of that author's argument like this, quote, "Hormones and surgery can and should be withheld from patients who want them when such treatments cannot be reasonably expected to, quote, maximize good outcomes." So, and then Chu tells a very personal story, which I'm going to quote from the piece. "Next Thursday, I will get a vagina. The procedure will last around 6 hours, and I'll be in recovery for at least 3 months. Until the day I die, my body will regard the vagina as a wound. As a result, it will require regular, painful attention to maintain. This is what I want, but there is no guarantee it will make me happier. In fact, I don't expect it to. That shouldn't disqualify me from getting it." So Chu argues in this essentially against the sort of gatekeeper theory that, first of all, that psychologists and medical doctors right now are gatekeepers for folks who want to transition. And if we are constantly, we in terms of people who advocate for trans folks and trans folks themselves, are constantly pushing this forward agenda of competent healthcare, and that transition is gender affirming and everything has to be sort of happy, then that sets us up to what happens when trans folks transition and aren't happy at some point or another. We still should, any one of us should be able to get transition related healthcare. But it was, if you read the whole piece, and we're going to tweet out the link, it was quite provocative. It showed up all over my social media feed and lots of people wrote in response to it. There's a great summary from the trans activist and a guest on the show before, Scott Turner Schofield, wrote on his Facebook page, "That editorial on being trans in the New York Times might be true for the writer, but literally every transgender person I know who has transitioned is screaming bullshit right now. And I join them." Amanda Carey wrote in The Advocate, "Chu, while correct that transition will not bring a magical cure from pain, chose the wrong forum to express her own agony. The New York Times opinion page is not a therapist's office. While yes, speaking out about the pain she feels does normalize the idea that hormones and surgery are not a cure for emotional trauma, but it's not the place to offer a nihilistic outlook on trans existence. Caitlin Burns of Rewire wrote, in attempting to complicate the trans narrative, Chu played to the audience of cis rubberneckers who love to gawk at medical transitions, and her own transition horrors overshadow whatever point she was trying to make about access to care. So lots of people had a lot of feelings, and it was certainly talked about a lot in my circles. So this week, someone sent me a piece that was published on Slate by Devin Price called The Dysphoria Paradox. I don't know if it was intentional, and we're going to find out in a minute, but I definitely thought that Price's piece was in conversation with the Chu piece. Price's piece has a subhead that reads, "For some trans people, treating gender dysphoria can temporarily worsen its severity, but that doesn't mean transition is dangerous." So tonight we're going to welcome the author themselves. Devin Price is a writer and social psychologist in Chicago. Devin's writing tackles topics ranging from academic labor practices to accurately measuring non-binary identity in survey research to the process of recovering from a copper IUD insertion. Their work has appeared in The Rumpus, The Toast, The Chicago Reader, and Slate, among others. Welcome to Sex Out Loud, Devin.
Hi, Tristan. Thank you for having me.
So before we dive into your piece, of course, I'm curious to know what you thought of the Chu piece in the New York Times.
Yeah. So I think Andrea Long Chu's piece has a place and a position that's really important because it does start to breach some of those nuances and some of those ambivalences that really do come from having a transition and it being painful in some ways. But I think ultimately throughout that piece of hers, the argument that she makes for why her transition is something that she should have the right to is this fundamentally kind of libertarian argument she kind of makes, that anybody should be allowed to do with their body what they want, regardless of whether they're happy with it or not. And for me, that just is one value that's important, and it kind of just focusing solely on that ignores the fact that a lot of people really do benefit in terms of their quality of life, their social functioning, and their emotional and psychological functioning from transitioning. So we can't act like it's just this body modification that is kind of neutral. On balance, most people who transition and do go through surgeries or other medical processes, they do benefit from it in the long term. So it's not the case that it's okay simply because anyone should be allowed to do whatever they want with their bodies, if that makes sense.
Yeah, I mean, in some ways, I felt like, oh, this would be a really great piece published in a trans or trans-inclusive publication. Like, if Out Magazine does the trans issue and we get to hear from, like, the myriad voices of trans people about their gender, their journeys, their struggles, their happiness, it would have made sense in that context. I feel like because it was in the New York Times, it was this giant platform that everyone read, you know, including my mother, and also, I think people were not necessarily thinking it was an opinion piece. So they were like, oh, wow, this is what trans people think, like all trans people, which, of course, was really problematic.
Right. Yeah. There's a lot of nuances to trans people's experiences. They're all so different. We all cope on slightly different trajectories and recover from dysphoria on slightly different trajectories. And so for that audience of like general New York Times readers, many of whom are still just getting a hold of basic trans 101 terminology, to have one of the most like bracing, full-throated trans voices that they see just saying, oh, I should be allowed to do this because anybody should be allowed to do whatever they want with their bodies, and, you know, it probably won't do anything lasting for me. That's not necessarily the most useful message for people who haven't heard the, you know, preponderance of trans people who have benefited in some way or another from medical transition or other kinds of transition.
And so I've talked about this in my opening, and I do wonder, was this piece that you wrote part of as a response to Choose Peace? Was it in conversation with Choose Peace? Was it influenced in any way by that one?
Yes, it was. And it was influenced also by some more recent pieces that came out in various different publications over the last couple weeks and months about this idea of rapid onset gender dysphoria. So The Atlantic has had pieces that have touched on this, for example. This idea that a lot of parents of trans kids in particular have, that trans people, once they come out as trans, or trans kids, once they articulate a trans identity to their families, all of a sudden they seem to have all of these new symptoms, and it seems like they have suddenly gotten a lot worse in terms of their mental health. And that's another kind of quote-unquote trans-critical thing that's been bubbling up a lot in mainstream publications. And it's a lot of times when publications publish things like that, they're doing a lot of their readers a disservice, because it kind of immediately puts this critical voice on transition forward before people have even learned kind of the basics of what a transition looks like for a lot of people. So I definitely wanted to kind of clear the air on some of these things, and also at the same time still have a really nuanced take that, yes, transitioning is hard. A lot of transitional steps are really unpleasant. Sometimes you get worse before you get better, and things like that.
Yeah, I mean, it just felt more nuanced and thoughtful, which is why I was drawn to it. I thought, oh my God, okay, now this this is a little less provocative than Andrea Chu. And also, I mean, Chu is like known for, you know, stirring up some shit here and there with their writing. So, so it wasn't surprising, definitely. But yeah. Okay, so let's take our first commercial break. When we come back, you're going to read an excerpt from your piece. So that will help listeners kind of locate what your piece is about. And then we will dive in. So stay with us, everyone. More with Devin Price when we get back. Happy New Year. I hope you're ending the old year and starting your new year off right by prioritizing your pleasure and sexuality. Our friends at The Pleasure Chest want to remind you that sex and pleasure is a practice, just like anything else, and it takes some level of commitment to keep it as a vital part of your life. Practicing pleasure can be as simple as committing to adding one thing to your routine that makes you feel more empowered in your body. Try a weekly bath dedicated to fantasizing. And of course, don't forget to pick up a little CBD bath bomb for that. Or wear a butt plug or Kegel balls when you do your weekly errand. Like any practice, the more sex you have, the more you want to have sex. Do you need a new year kickstart? A perfect place to learn more is through their Pleasure Ed program, a year-round series of free, inclusive, pleasure-based workshops offered at their LA, New York, and Chicago locations. And a few Pleasure Chest locations will be featuring happy hour workshops at an earlier time, so you can drop by for a drink and stock up on some G-spot, bondage, electrosex tips, you know, on your way home from work. Plus, all workshop attendees receive 15% off their purchase. If you can't make it in, you can always go to pleasurechest.com and get yourself something special. Also, they've got great sex ed information on there. Remember, if you use coupon code Tristan at checkout, you get a free massage candle with every purchase.
Hi everyone, we're Emma and Finn, the hosts of the Normalizing Non-Monogamy podcast. Each Wednesday, we interview people from across the spectrum of non-monogamy to hear and learn from their stories.
So far, we've interviewed a wide variety of guests covering swinging, polyamory, kink, cuckolding, and much more.
Even with all of these guests, we know that there are so many different dynamics and stories to tell that we've only scratched the surface.
So we'd love to have you stop by and give Normalizing Non-Monogamy a listen, and maybe even share your story someday.
Streaming live, the leader in internet talk radio, VoiceAmerica.com.
You're tuned in to Sex Out Loud with your host, Tristan Taramino. We want to hear from you. If you have a question or comment, please send an email to Tristan@puckerup.com. That's Tristan@puckerup.com. Now back to the show.
Welcome back to Sex Out Loud, everyone. Hey, again, if you want to join the conversation, you can call us at 866-472-5788, 866-472-5788. I am talking today with my guest, Devin Price, about their recent article on Slate called The Dysphoria Paradox. And I wanted to give you all kind of a taste of Devin's piece. And so they have agreed to read a little bit whenever you're ready.
Okay. Yeah. So in the full piece, I go into some of the like research on this topic, but I'm just going to give people a taste of the bit that's a little bit more personal. Every time I take a step forward in my gender transition, I go into it expecting immediate relief. I will be so comfortable in my skin after I do this, I imagine, so free. And yet, after completing a given transitional step, getting a haircut, changing my name or gender marker, coming out to friends and loved ones, I'm instead met with a sudden rush of anxiety and self-consciousness. Instead of feeling authentic and unburdened, I start worrying I'm a ludicrous fraud. After a time, these tightly wound, anxious feelings recede, and I end up loving myself and the changes that I've made. Cutting my hair, changing my name and gender marker, going on testosterone, coming out to loved ones were all good ideas, ones that helped me to drop a social veil that long kept me alienated from other people. But that doesn't mean those veils weren't intensely terrifying to drop. At times, I've worried that pursuing authenticity via gender transition was just another form of fakery, like pretending to be a cisgender woman was for most of my life. In other moments, pursuing my ideal body and gender presentation has made me acutely aware of how far from my goals I am. I have often felt social pressure to turn back, to stop making myself a spectacle in my pursuit of honesty, to grow my hair out, wear makeup, let the she's and hers fly in my direction freely. It sometimes seems like it would be easier to ignore my identity and stop fighting for its recognition. I could carry on unseen for decades, repressing my dysphoria at every turn. But ultimately, I can't deny the ways in which transition has made my life better. The improvements to my body image, confidence, and self-esteem were all worth the temporary pain of transition. Psychological research is consistent with my experience. Transition improves long-term mental health and well-being for the vast majority of people who go through it. But supporting trans people and their transitions requires that we dispense with the expectation of immediate joy. Trans people deserve the freedom to have messy, gradual, honest recoveries from the symptoms they were once forced to suffer with in silence. No trans person recovers from a lifetime of dysphoria in a day.
So, Devin, this resonated with a lot of people. And as someone who has a partner who's in their first year of transition, it really resonated with me a lot. As just someone who's partnering with someone and sort of witnessing their process. And he gave me permission to talk about this, people. So if you're out there going, oh my God, I know who your boyfriend is, he gave me permission. So I love this idea that there's an expectation that if you have lived 15 years, 20 years, 30 years, 40 years with gender dysphoria, that the transition process is going to then take that all away kind of almost instantly, which seems in some ways kind of keeping with this sort of American medical values of like, let's cure it, let's fix it, and let's do it now, right? Let's not show kind of the messy underpinnings of it all. Let's just show the before picture and the after picture and look, it's great now. But you really do raise the idea that it could actually get worse before it gets better. It can get better and then worse and then better and then worse. I mean, basically like life for people.
Right. Yeah. And just like dealing with any other kind of trauma, especially if you've been putting it off or you've been forced to put off acknowledging it for years and years and years, you can't just open up that box and then just immediately be unburdened and relieved. Like, we love to believe in that kind of catharsis. And honestly, we also put the same expectation on any kind of queer person coming out, right? Like, straight and cis people seem to think that, like, you come out of the closet and you have this big parade and it's like years of living in a heteronormative world didn't actually fuck you up and it's over, right? So we have trouble as a society dealing with the idea that queer people and traumatized people, once they share what they've been through, that that we're all going to have to reckon with the damage that was done, in a sense that we can't just kind of say, oh, it's done now, let's all get over it.
Well, and it also takes out the context of if you were queer and maybe not out but still faced homophobia, and then you're queer and you come out, you're still going to face homophobia. So it's the same for trans people. I think even those who were deeply closeted or adhered to some kind of gender norms, when they come out, then transphobia is right there, like waiting for them at the door.
Right, exactly. And that first year, a couple of years of transition can be the hardest in terms of your appearance is changing probably pretty rapidly. You're trying on maybe all the different new types of clothing that just makes you feel uncomfortable. And you have something for many of us that's making you this big lightning rod for harassment from other people. So it can immediately make you feel like, oh, is it really worth it? I'm not getting this wonderful gasp of freedom that I thought I was going to have. I'm just getting a lot of shit from people. And so it can really make you doubt yourself and feel like, oh, is this even what I wanted? Is this even worth it? And it's only once you really push through some of that, get a little bit more comfortable in your own skin, that you start to kind of see why you went through it in the first place. But, you know, that doesn't mean that you ever escaped some of the transphobia. Certainly some people deal with that the whole rest of their lives.
Mm-hmm. Do you think it's also because people desperately want there to be like a cure? Like as in with other medical things, like your cancer is gone. You know what I mean?
Yeah. It's the same way we treat like people with chronic illnesses or disabilities that like, oh, you know, you got a diagnosis, so you're better now, right? And it's like, no, this is actually an ongoing thing with flare-ups and really expensive treatments and things like that. And I think that's also connected to how binary our expectations are for trans people. Like, oh, you're a trans woman, so once you start looking like my image of what a woman should look like, everything's fine, and it's, we can just pretend you're like any other woman, quote unquote, you know, like this very like cis binary expectation that like it's a thing that you treat and you fix and you put someone into a particular box or social role and then it settles.
Okay, so you talked about in the last segment this concept of rapid onset gender dysphoria. I want you to tease that out a little more and just give us the context for kind of who is crying about rapid onset gender dysphoria.
Right. Yeah. So this is something that you hear primarily in trans critical, quote unquote, circles. So people who are either trans exclusionary radical feminists, TERFs, or sometimes in a less troubling way or more morally complicated way. Sometimes you hear it from parents who have trans children that aren't being fully supportive of those trans kids, maybe aren't fully informed on trans issues or just kind of confused or conflicted. There's this idea that that being trans is a social contagion that you can catch from having trans friends or from being on Tumblr too long or something like that. And so this idea of rapid onset gender dysphoria is you decide or you're convinced that you're trans and now all of a sudden you have gender dysphoria when you've never had it before. So you start expressing discomfort with your body or being socially anxious and being uncomfortable in the gender role you've been pushed into by society. And what's really going on there, I think, a lot of the time is someone who's trans is suddenly being open about something that they've been struggling with their whole life. But this is the first time their parent or spouse has ever heard them share it, and so it seems like it's coming out of nowhere. And that's kind of what that mythology is, and it's something that in kind of trans exclusionary circles is sometimes presented as being trans is this social contagion, and all these people are catching gender dysphoria and creating a problem that isn't actually there.
I mean, certainly there are more trans people today than there were 50 years ago, but that has to do with A, visibility. You know, more and more dialogue, more and more visibility. People keep, you know, who tell me I don't know a trans person. It's like, you don't know that you know a trans person, right? Because people have often been closeted about it. And access to medical care for trans folks has changed dramatically. So if the issue is, oh my God, it seems like more people are trans, I think that needs to be contextualized also.
Right. Yeah. People have a hard time distinguishing, is there more people with this trait, with this quality, with this experience versus are we just more aware of people with this trait, this quality, this experience? The same thing happens with having better diagnostic categories for ADHD and autism. It's a great thing. More people are getting help these days than ever did before and are understanding themselves than ever did before. But some people see it as this epidemic that needs to be quashed and destroyed. And I think it's a similar experience with queer people of a variety of types. More people identify as bisexual than ever have in the past, but it's not an epidemic. It's more people feeling comfortable and informed to embrace who they are.
Right, right. And also, don't you think, I mean, I always feel like when the critics really want to stir the pot, the first place they go is to kids. like save the children. Like they don't want to talk to people who are adults who transitioned in adulthood because they're like, okay, we don't know if we can like make a case there, but let us try to make a case for these children, these young, impressionable children whose brains are barely even developed. And don't you think that's kind of a red herring?
I think it is. It is always such a great way to kind of hijack a conversation and make it seem like it's the end of the world that you like let your kid get a haircut or use certain pronouns. Obviously, people did the same thing with gay rights and just the fear that that kids would be corrupted and made gay or be preyed upon. We do so much to like make children this flashpoint in our society anytime there's some kind of political battle on the line. And it's just really, and it just inflames people. It makes people feel so worried about making the wrong decision with their kid, about screwing something up. And so, yeah, it really is so good at derailing conversations.
And I think it's a way, now that trans folks have gained a certain amount of visibility and, let's just put this in scare quotes, credibility, it's a way for folks to still work out their own issues by criticizing transgender kids. It's like, okay, if the adults seem like they have it together now, we got to shift the focus and say, no, this still isn't okay. What's the right age? What's the wrong age? How much medical intervention do they need? What kind of medical intervention? It seems like it's like shifting from the adults to the kids in this idea of sort of like, what about the kids? Like compassion, but it's actually just shifting their transphobia.
Right. It's that classic, I don't have a problem with these group of people. I'm just worried about the implication for kids. It's a way to kind of speak out of both sides of your mouth and kind of hurt everybody in the process.
Right. Okay, we're going to take another break. Hey, do you want to join us in talking about gender dysphoria? Why not? It's Friday night, people. You can call us at 866-472-5788. I'm actually curious to hear if folks have read these articles and we've tweeted out the links to them, what you think. Now, if you're not listening live, you can still tell me your comments and thoughts by calling our 24-hour voicemail line, 323-SEX-8266, 323-SEX-8266. Don't go anywhere. Listen to these ads and we'll be back. Hey gang, you may already know about the tried and true Clone a Willy to make a silicone replica of any penis. In fact, a while back we had actual listeners try it out and their reviews were stellar. Well, now there's something brand new. The Clone a Pussy Plus Sleeve Kit. First of its kind, Clone a Pussy Plus allows anyone to cast an exact replica of a vulva in silicone and attach it to the included silicone masturbation sleeve. This is a truly one-of-a-kind toy and perfect for long-distance relationships. The creation process itself can be really fun, and the results make a great gift for any occasion. Clone a Willy is a woman-run company, and their products are sourced in the U.S. and hand-assembled in Portland, Oregon. And you know I've got a deal for you. Use the promo code Tristan for 20% off your entire order on cloneawilly.com. Hey, why don't you clone it and bone it? Happy New Year. I hope you're ending the old year and starting your new year off right by prioritizing your pleasure and sexuality. Our friends at the Pleasure Chest want to remind you that sex and pleasure is a practice, just like anything else, and it takes some level of commitment to keep it as a vital part of your life. Practicing pleasure can be as simple as committing to adding one thing to your routine that makes you feel more empowered in your body. Try a weekly bath dedicated to fantasizing. And of course, don't forget to pick up a little CBD bath bomb for that. Or wear a butt plug or Kegel balls when you do your weekly errand. Like any practice, the more sex you have, the more you want to have sex. Do you need a new year kickstart? A perfect place to learn more is through their Pleasure Ed program, a year-round series of free, inclusive, pleasure-based workshops offered at their LA, New York, and Chicago locations. And a few Pleasure Chest locations will be featuring happy hour workshops at an earlier time, so you can drop by for a drink and stock up on some G-spot, bondage, electrosex tips, you know, on your way home from work. Plus, all workshop attendees receive 15% off their purchase. If you can't make it in, you can always go to pleasurechest.com and get yourself something special. Also, they've got great sex ed information on there. Remember, if you use coupon code Tristan at checkout, you get a free massage candle with every purchase.
The Internet's number one talk station. Number one talk station. VoiceAmerica.com.
You're tuned in to Sex Out Loud with your host, Tristan Taramino. We want to hear from you. If you have a question or comment, please send an email to Tristan@puckerup.com. That's Tristan@puckerup.com. Now back to the show.
Welcome back to Sex Out Loud, everyone. Hey, I want to welcome back a returning advertiser, Clone a Willy. Listen, they've advertised before on the show and they've been very, very supportive. And actually, you can even go to their website and see a picture of my dog who is modeling like a drink cozy with their branding on it. It's a long story about how that happened, but if you want to go look for it, go for it. I actually just came back from ANME, which is the sex toy manufacturers trade show. And so I got to see this brand new product, which is called Clone a Pussy Plus. So in this one, they've had Clone a Pussy before and Clone a Willy. This one comes with now a sleeve kit. So you know those masturbation sleeves where it essentially is like a sleeve that's contained in a container that looks kind of like a giant flashlight. I'm not going to say their name, you know, until they give me money. I'm not saying their name. And so this is exactly like that. You do the replica of the vulva, any vulva, and then you attach it to this existing silicone sleeve that's in one of those plastic containers, and you can like change the suction. It's really amazing, and you guys should totally check it out. And if you didn't write it down, the code is Tristan, and you get 20% off your order. And the website is cloneawilly.com. So this discussion was making me think of something I heard about today, which is that there's a great site which is basically like resources for the parents of trans kids, and it's called transkids.com. And essentially, it was set up by a sex educator who also happens to have their own gender nonconforming child. And part of it, besides like resources and message boards and FAQs and definitions and all that stuff, they also do sell products so that parents could buy products that are gender affirming for their kids. And recently, like the right-wing people got a hold of this and have gone totally bananas on the internet about it, saying super, super fucked up things, both about trans kids and about the website. And the person who runs it, Sarah, has actually gotten doxxed and threatened and harassed online. She has another business, which is in Chicago, and it's a retail store, totally different. And they've actually gone to Yelp and left all these crazy negative reviews for her other store. I mean, they're like on the warpath. And I think this is another, I think this is sort of one of the concerns, right, Devin, that we're so careful about sort of what we put out there because our enemies can weaponize it.
Right. And then when it even touches kids tangentially, people become so much more inflamed. In the same way that you see anti-choice activists use really extreme violence, or just homophobic activists who are worried about gay teachers just really feel like it's some kind of life and death crusade that they're on. And it just becomes something that just really people react so strongly to just the idea of one child getting one bit of like solace and comfort and understanding from their parent in a world that's so prone to misunderstanding them. It's just so ridiculous and sad.
You know, you talked about in your piece sort of why sometimes gender dysphoria sort of gets worse before it gets better and other things get worse before they get better. You talked about practicing mindfulness to address your anxiety, and you said, I'm now constantly paying attention to my anxiety levels, and it's unpleasant. This is a favorite piece of mine. Like, it's almost like when you, I mean, my boyfriend, his thing was like, he started going to therapy. He's been in therapy before, but not to deal with these particular issues. And he's like, I feel worse than I've ever felt before. And I'm like, sounds like a great therapist.
Right. Yeah.
Which is not like that comforting, but what I mean is once you start to uncover it, it can get a little dark in there before you can see the light out.
Right. Yeah. And that's not to say that you have to like re-traumatize yourself and have this super dark, like, oh, I'm going to list every horrible thing that ever happened to me kind of thing. But it's just the case that like, even if you're just trying to like keep track of a symptom, how bad is my dysphoria today? How bad is my anxiety today or during this hour? Like, you're going to be thinking about it so much more and all its little fluctuations, and you're going to notice all the little things that set it off, and you're thinking about it all the time. And it's like, I yell at my therapist all the time, like, this sucks. I hate this. I just want to, like, not have feelings and not be a person like I was trying to be before. Why are you doing this to me? And that's the way that treating something often has to start. You have to first really be good at tracking it. And that sucks, but it really does help you in the long run.
Yeah, but in some ways, I do think, and this isn't true for everyone, and I'm not judging, but some trans folks do use transition as an opportunity to also, you know, raise their level of self-awareness or dig into some of their other issues that are not gender related necessarily. And so this idea, you know, I think I read either in Choose Peace or yours or one of them about how, like, suicide rates don't go down enough. So suicide rates are incredibly high for trans folks and gender nonconforming folks. And there was something about how, like, suicide rates, like, don't go down enough after you've transitioned. And so, like, we don't have a measurable difference here. But it seems to me if you're then, like, leaning into your depression, leaning into your PTSD, we're not accounting that could be hard, and also that people who are trans have mental health issues just like the general population.
Right. Yeah. So the first thing is that most studies looking at suicidality in trans people only compare trans people to cis people. We don't have really good data comparing a trans person before transition to after transition for the most part. And so a lot of times when people say, oh, trans people have elevated risks of suicide and it doesn't get better, it's compared to cis people who never had to go through the particular kinds of traumas and symptoms that us trans people do go through. So we don't, you know, so sometimes you can point to that and say, oh, well, that means transition is useless, when really it's the case that, no, it just is really hard to be trans. Like, nothing is going to take away the decades of trauma that we've all had. We're still going to be at an elevated level of risk compared to people who aren't trans. But that doesn't mean that, like, we shouldn't work on treating dysphoria or that we should try to not be trans or something like that. It just means this is a real societal injustice and a reality that not only we have to live with, but the people that care about us have to live with and work on fixing in a systemic way, too.
Also part of this discussion is this idea of gatekeeping, and I'm wondering what your thoughts are. I was at a conference on health disparities for GLBTQ folks recently, and this woman gave an amazing presentation who is a leading doctor for trans folks in Los Angeles, and, you know, she was doing a real, like, sort of trans 101 formal presentation, but she also had these, like, little side things that she would say, and they were, like, really snarky. And one of them was about the procedures that trans people have to go through. And she was like, you know, so for example, I have to write a letter on my letterhead saying what trans people already know about themselves. Which I thought was a brilliant statement. Especially at a professional conference, you know? I mean, it was like, tell us how you really feel. But what do you think about this gatekeeping issue, that the first line that you have to get through are medical professionals, some of whom may not even understand?
Yeah, you know, so I've had a really easy time relative to other trans people because I have here in Chicago the Howard Brown Health Center, which is a informed consent clinic, which is starting to be a little bit of the wave of the future for trans people. The idea that you don't need to present as your gender for a year before you're allowed to get hormones, which that used to be the rule for decades and decades. This idea that just you need to be informed of the risks and kind of checked in with a doctor about kind of whether you're kind of able to consent to starting hormones or getting surgery. And once you have been kind of debriefed on what some of the potential risks are, you're allowed to make that decision for yourself. That has made my life so much easier. And it's certainly helped a lot of people with access issues to hormones and surgeries and things like that here throughout Chicago. And really that's all it has to come down to, is making sure a person is cognizant of what they're putting into their body and then trusting them to make that decision.
Right, right. Instead of sort of jumping through. Because then I've also, you know, heard that then for each like legal thing you want to do, if you want to change your gender marker on various legal documents, each like agency or government organization wants like a different kind of letter from a different kind of doctor. And so there's all this like sort of red tape and bureaucracy, which you have to go through. And again, it's all about kind of gatekeeping and who gets to decide like what's going to be on your license and what's going to be in your social security card. And if you're going to get a new birth certificate, depending on what state you live in.
And it's so ridiculous. I'll tell you, like when I went to get my gender marker changed at the DMV here in Chicago, they almost turned me away because my doctor's letter was in black and white instead of color. Like it's that specific and asinine.
I hear these like stories all the time, which are just super, super frustrating. And it's sort of at the discretion of this one or maybe two people who don't necessarily have any education and training. They're kind of making a call on their own, which is confusing, but it sort of like reminds me of the TSA. It's what I call the hummus problem, which is that half the time when I bring hummus on the plane, the TSA is like, sure, go right through. And the other half, it's like, no, that's like a gel or a paste. You can't have that. But it never makes any sense and there's no logic to it. Okay, that's my hummus story. Let's take another break. And when we come back, we will continue the conversation. So more with Devin Price when we return. Hey gang, you may already know about the tried and true Clone a Willy to make a silicone replica of any penis. In fact, a while back, we had actual listeners try it out and their reviews were stellar. Well, now there's something brand new. The Clone a Pussy Plus Sleeve Kit. First of its kind, Clone a Pussy Plus allows anyone to cast an exact replica of a vulva in silicone and attach it to the included silicone masturbation sleeve. This is a truly one-of-a-kind toy and perfect for long-distance relationships. The creation process itself can be really fun, and the results make a great gift for any occasion. Clone a Willy is a woman-run company, and their products are sourced in the U.S. and hand-assembled in Portland, Oregon. And you know I've got a deal for you. Use the promo code Tristan for 20% off your entire order on cloneawilly.com. Hey, why don't you clone it and bone it?
Hi, everyone. We're Emma and Finn, the hosts of the Normalizing Non-Monogamy podcast. Each Wednesday, we interview people from across the spectrum of non-monogamy to hear and learn from their stories.
So far, we've interviewed a wide variety of guests covering swinging, polyamory, kink, cuckolding, and much more.
Even with all of these guests, we know that there are so many different dynamics and stories to tell that we've only scratched the surface.
So we'd love to have you stop by and give Normalizing Non-Monogamy a listen, and maybe even share your story someday.
Stimulating talk
gets those synapses in the brain firing really fast.
All the time.
The number one internet talk station where your opinion counts. VoiceAmerica.com.
You're tuned in to Sex Out Loud with your host, Tristan Taramino. We want to hear from you. If you have a question or comment, please send an email to Tristan at puckerup.com. That's Tristan at puckerup.com. Now back to the show.
Welcome back to Sex Out Loud, everyone. Hey, you know I've been telling you about these Care of vitamins. Basically, you go on their website, takecareof.com. You fill out this very simple, straightforward quiz about, you know, what you eat, what you drink, what you do, and then it makes this customized vitamin program for you. Then you sign up for a subscription, and right to your door are delivered these little packets that are custom made for you. And I've been doing it now for about a month. I absolutely love it. I love that they have these little packets so I can just throw them in my purse and go, and I don't have to count pills and like pill boxes and all that stuff. And it's great. I've told you guys it's great. But here's the thing. They're having a super amazing, awesome sale, and it's only for January. So you have very little time to take advantage of this. It's 50% off your first month. 50% off when you use the coupon code Tristan. So I've advertised before for the 25. This is the 50, people. Now is the time. Takecareof.com. So we're talking today with Devin Price. And Devin, one of the things I read about in your bio is how you've written about how we accurately measure non-binary identity in research, which begs the question, how do we accurately measure non-binary identity in research?
So to answer that question, I'll first answer with my biggest pet peeve that I see the most often as a researcher in other people's surveys. This is when a researcher is trying to include trans people, but they don't know what they're doing. The question will be what gender do you identify as, or what's your gender? And the options will be man, woman, or male and female. And then the last one will just be transgender. I've seen that so many times. Every time I see it, I die. I have a hashtag bad gender measures that I always tweet it under. This idea that that's a third gender category, and that if you're a trans man, what are you supposed to pick? Male, because that's your gender, or transgender because you're a transgender man.
And what if you're non-binary? There's not even an other category to write in? Yeah.
No. So it's slowly over the years gotten better and better, but that's the vast majority of people who are even thinking to try. Before that, there's the whole scores of people who just have male and female, but a lot, even the people who are trying sometimes do that. My personal recommendation is to just have an open-ended option for everybody. So not male, female, and then, whatever weird other gender you are, which is kind of the message that you give off if you have two categories and then an open-ended one. Just leave it open-ended, see what words a person uses to describe themselves, and then put the time into coding it and categorizing it. It's more labor-intensive than just having, two options or three options that immediately fill into a little spreadsheet telling you how many people picked each option. But it's the best way to let people use the language that's appropriate and comfortable for them. And if somebody needs to use multiple terms to really encompass who they are, then it allows them to do that. And it's also a way that you'll always be kind of on the cutting edge as new words become more popular or get adopted. So that's really what I recommend. If I do see a male, female, and open-ended other, that's at least giving non-binary people and people with more complicated, nuanced gender identities, it's at least making it possible to measure them, but it is still kind of treating them like an afterthought. So that's still not ideal.
Right. The data heads would be an open-ended what? So many researchers present at conferences that I'm at, and they're so into their data and their numbers, and open-ended fields is their worst nightmare.
Right. Yeah. And I'm a quantitative person. I love closed-ended items. I understand they're easier to throw into a stats program and analyze, but a lot of times you do have to actually put in the work of measuring what a person's actual reality is in their own words, and then looking at that from the bottom up and letting that influence your analyses, which a lot of people aren't prepared to do yet. And I hope they get more comfortable taking a dive into the deeper data like that.
Well, and I think also there's no basic standard right now of how to do gender on an intake form. People are winging it, and some people are trying some things, and there's obviously people who are way ahead of the curve, and there's great stuff being done at Fenway in Boston and at the Harvard Medical School, and there's a lot of people who have publicized here's what we think is best practices, but then there's a lot of people who just don't know and they're still trying to sort of figure out.
Right. Yeah. Unless you work at a clinic that is intentionally serving trans people and marginalized queer people, and you get some mandatory training on what language to use, you might not ever really encounter this stuff. I'm an academic. I work with psychologists and professors in various other fields, and a lot of them have no training in this kind of stuff, especially if they've been in their careers for decades. And so people are just kind of winging it. And that's if you're lucky, and trans people are on their radar, at least as a thing that exists. So we just really, need to do better and make that information more available. And also, if you're in a research or medical field, you have to really take responsibility for, learning some basic terminology.
Yeah. I also heard a medical professional recently, suggest the idea that if you're going specifically for medical care, that you do an inventory of organs. It sounded very nerdy and weird, but I was Oh, so basically it's like, it's totally neutral. It's just like, what do you have? Like, what do you have?
Yeah.
And now what then do we need to screen for, test for, think about, ask about? It's an interesting idea, right?
Yeah.
Because then you could say, I have ovaries. You could say, I have ovaries. And then we don't even need to get into the gender stuff. It's just, I have ovaries. Okay. Well, now this is what you need if you have ovaries.
Yeah. I think that approach in a medical context is so much more useful than saying, oh, but we need to ask about biology because we're screening for conditions that only happen in certain organs. Like, yes, that's true. But you don't necessarily have more useful information from knowing whether somebody is legally female or legally male or assigned male at birth, assigned female at birth, because you don't know what parts they have right now. And that's not just trans people. That's people who have had hysterectomies for other reasons, people who weren't born with certain body parts, intersex people, so many other situations. And you know what? I kind of feel the same way about when an event is marketed towards women and femmes or something like that. Like, just say people affected by misogyny, if that's what you mean, or something like that. A lot of times we try to use inclusive language on gender and dance around what we actually mean, which is really like, do you have this body part? Do you experience sexism? You know, things like that.
I mean, technically everyone experiences misogyny in one form or another. It doesn't, you know, like, I mean, I think it's, there are misogynistic things perpetuated on people who are women, female identified, non-binary, more often by cis men, but misogyny is everywhere, and cis men can also be the subject of it if they're not like adhering to certain social norms and gender norms.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. It's a cultural toxin that infects everybody to a certain degree, for sure.
And are you seeing more research? I mean, you know, we just talked about how, oh, we don't have any research on suicide rates before and after transition. Also, how do we even measure after? Because it's like a lifelong process. But are you seeing more research out there about trans and non-binary folks? Or is there still these huge vacuums?
It's getting better. But what I would say is it's really easy to look like there's a big percentage jump forward when there was so little in the first place, right? Mm-hmm. So there are a lot of big jumps. I kind of read in a lot of different literature just, you know, for funsies. So, for example, the eating disorder literature used to be all about cisgender women, primarily mm-hmm. cisgender white women from wealthy backgrounds, and that was it. In the 90s and, like, 2000s, we started to finally get research on men's eating disorders. Still really underrepresented to an awful degree, but it's getting there. And now we're finally starting to see work that looks specifically at how is eating disordered behavior related to being trans, because for a lot of us, there is some overlap there, both for binary trans people and non-binary trans people. So that's a research area where I've seen a lot of improvement. And a lot of kind of psychological and psychosocial research topics seem to be the ones that are more at the forefront of researchers knowing about these issues, some researchers being trans themselves, and really helping to fill those gaps. Where you see slower motion forward in my experience is in the medical realm. It just seems like there's just more gatekeeping there. There's just a little bit more just like hierarchies of power that make it really hard to introduce research that goes against the status quo. So that's where it's a little bit slower and harder to make a really big splash.
Well, you're going to make really big splash, and I really appreciate you writing this article and being on the show.
Thank you so much for having me.
You can find Devin's work on medium.com. Just search Devon Price, DevonPrice. They are on Twitter at Dr. Dr. _E Price and on Instagram at Dr. Devon Price. I want to thank everyone who makes this show possible. Executive producer Karen Dana, senior producer Raymond Johnson, announcer Cooper Beckett, A-Rod, my engineer, everyone at Voice America. Tune in next Friday, 5 p.m. Pacific, 8 p.m. Eastern. We're going to welcome back one of my favorite guests, Bevan Brand Landingham. And she's going to talk about her just released video series based on her worldwide phenomenon class called Fat Kid Dance Party. So you don't want to miss that. Till next time.
That's a wrap on today's show. Go to voiceamerica.com to listen to this and other episodes on demand or as podcasts. And make sure you come back next Friday night at 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 Pacific, for Sex Out Loud with Tristan Taramino on Voice America Variety.